Read and hear more about important news and policy issues at ncpolicywatch.com. This is News and Views.
Welcome to News and Views. I'm your host, Rob Schofield. Well, with the arrival of the first week in October, the U.S. Supreme Court has commenced a new term and is already plunging into a crowded docket of potentially momentous cases, including at least two that could upend some long-established rules for how elections are conducted in our country. One of those cases is Moore v. Harper, a case brought by North Carolina Republican lawmakers who say they should be free under something they've dubbed the Independent State Legislature Theory, or ISLT, to draw congressional district maps with no oversight by state courts. And earlier this week, I caught up with Tom Wolfe, deputy director of the Democracy Program at the Brennan Center for Justice, to learn more about the case and the threat it poses to U.S. elections.
Well, Tom Wolfe, welcome to News and Views. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
The topic of today's conversation is Moore versus Harper, which is a case that people across the country are watching. The Moore in this case is actually the Speaker of the North Carolina House, Tim Moore. It's an incredibly important case about how we draw legislative districts in the future in our country. And perhaps you can tell us a little bit about it and how it got to the U.S. Supreme Court.
Happy to do so. So Moore v. Harper is a case coming out of the North Carolina Supreme Court, the greater state court system. Essentially, what happened here was the North Carolina General Assembly created a congressional map for the U.S. House races that was heavily gerrymandered in favor of the Republican Party, who controlled the map drawing process. A group of voters and also nonprofits brought a variety of lawsuits. Those suits ended up winning. They had a trial court declare the map illegal under the North Carolina state constitution. And there were appeals all the way up the chain to the North Carolina Supreme Court. The North Carolina Supreme Court agreed that the map violated several protections in the North Carolina Constitution, including the Free and Fair Elections Clause, First Amendment, equal protection. The legislators who had gerrymandered the map were not happy with that outcome, and so they appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court. And the crux of their claim is that under the Elections Clause in the U.S. Constitution, no state entity other than the state legislature is allowed to set the rules for federal elections, including the lines for districts in federal races. So the state Supreme Court did not have the power to come in and knock their map down using the North Carolina state constitution. That's a version of what's known sort of colloquially as the independent state legislature theory. They call it a doctrine, but a doctrine implies something that has a deep pedigree. This thing is made up and it doesn't have that kind of background. But, you know, to sort of step back from the kind of legal ins and outs, ultimately what this case is about is a group of legislators who have kind of outsized power over the elections process in North Carolina, trying to melt down the system of checks and balances that have long governed the way elections are run, not only in North Carolina, but all around the country for centuries. So checks and balances are ultimately what's at stake here.
We should point out, of course, that there's no real dispute that it's gerrymandered. The Republicans aren't arguing that they didn't do that, right?
Exactly. Their argument at this point is just that they're allowed to do it, and there is no way for the state Supreme Court to step in and stop them using the state constitution.
We perhaps should also note that North Carolina is among the states in which the governor, although he has the power to veto certain legislation, he doesn't, or she doesn't, have the power to veto a redistricting bill. So again, it's completely in the hands of the General Assembly, which has been dominated by the Republican Party for the last decade or so. But we should also note that gerrymandering isn't anything particularly new. When the Democrats ran the General Assembly here in North Carolina, they too gerrymandered legislative districts. And it's not something that the Republican Party has a monopoly on across the country.
You know, so a few things on that point. I mean, first of all, what you're just saying about both parties doing it when they're in power points up the danger of the independent state legislature theory, because what it does is it clears the decks for whatever party controls the legislature in North Carolina to maximize their advantage to, you know, the exclusion and the detriment of other parties. And so whoever gets that power, if the Supreme Court makes the independent state legislature theory the law of the land, which it isn't yet, but if they did, they'd be getting rid of all of those checks and balances. So, you know, both sides' oxes can be gored here. Another thing, you know, you noted the governor doesn't have the ability to veto the maps, and that's unique around the country, but it also points up a little bit of what's been happening throughout the states recently, where legislatures are trying all different ways to push their advantage. And in addition to gerrymandering the maps, in a manner of speaking, they also kind of gerrymander the laws in an attempt to give them additional advantages. In this case, I think the legislature was a little too clever by half. So they actually passed a series of statutes that give the North Carolina courts the ability to review maps under the North Carolina Constitution and strike them down and redraw them. So, you know, this case is about the independent state legislature theory, mainly because the gerrymandering legislators are trying to make it about it. But even if you thought the theory was correct, which I don't, here they're kind of up the creek without a paddle, because they, the legislature, have passed laws that have said, state court, you can do this. Now they're trying to get out of this mess that they're in, basically by minimizing the importance of that state law, what we would call delegation of power to the court. Mm-hmm. And they're saying, well, we didn't have, even have the ability to do that. So the laws that even we passed are illegal. It's a truly wild posture for a legislature to take.
We're talking with Tom Wolf, who's deputy director of the Democracy Program at the Brennan Center for Justice. Another interesting aspect of this story, I guess, here in North Carolina is that North Carolina maps have been up to the U.S. Supreme Court before. There was a lawsuit challenging maps as being politically gerrymandered as opposed to racially gerrymandered, which is pretty well established that you can't do under the Constitution. And the U.S. Supreme Court said, per Justice Roberts, said, that's not us, you guys. That's for your state courts to deal with. Is that a fair assessment of the previous directive that we got from the U.S. Supreme Court?
Yeah, exactly. In 2019, in a case called Rucho v. Common Cause, representing a large group of voters in the state, tried to get partisan gerrymanders struck down under the U.S. Constitution. They actually won below. And then when it went up to the Supreme Court, the Supreme Court said, you know, I know for the last few decades, we've sort of suggested that you might be able to strike down partisan gerrymanders with our Constitution, but we're telling you, you can't. Federal courts can't get in the business. We're taking ourselves out of this. If you've got an issue, and they said this in their majority opinion, if you have an issue with partisan gerrymandering, that's why state courts and state constitutions exist. You can go there and figure it out in your state courts. So that's exactly what voters did this decade. They went to state court and they won. And now we're back up in front of the Supreme Court. And now the legislators are asking the Supreme Court to say, oh, actually, no, you can't go to your state court either, which, you know, points up several additional troubling things here. So when we're talking about the movement to end partisan gerrymandering, which has actually been quite successful in the last decade or so, that movement would be kneecapped because you could no longer turn to your state. It really points up the extent to which the independent state legislature theory is kind of about aggrandizing legislators and the U.S. Supreme Court, because effectively what they're saying is once legislators draw their lines or make their voting rules for federal elections, none of these state level checks and balances are going to exist anymore. The only people that will be able to check this is us, the U.S. Supreme Court. They have a fantastic record on protecting voters' rights. The sort of third wrinkle to that, the court heard an argument today in a case called Merrill v. Milligan, which involved the Voting Rights Act. The court's already issued several disastrous opinions, really reducing the effectiveness of the Voting Rights Act over the last 10 to 15 years. If you can't remedy your partisan gerrymandering redistricting claims, and then the VRA is reduced, when you show up in federal court, there's very little you're going to be able to get from a federal court. So the court's kind of cutting away, or it's not even giving with one hand and taking with the other. It's basically taking with both hands.
Yeah.
And just asking you not to pay attention to what the left hand's doing while the right hand's doing what it's doing. So it's not a great dynamic, and it should be very troublesome for people who are watching.
We thought that the Supreme Court and Justice Roberts had sent a pretty clear directive. Look, you guys, your remedies with state courts. Now, at least four justices, I guess it is Alito, Thomas, Gorsuch, and Kavanaugh, have said, no, we're going to take a look at this one too. Do we have any idea? What's the speculation on what the posture of the court is and where things stand? And I guess even more importantly, what would happen if they actually did rule in favor in some way of this so-called theory about independent state legislatures?
Maybe I'll handle the questions in reverse. So, I mean,
sure.
The reason why we're really concerned about the theory is because it would eliminate all these checks and balances. It would make legislatures supreme, and they're amongst the most radical political actors in the country. Today, it would throw election administration into chaos, actually just running elections from a nuts and bolts level, because a lot of the rules that govern our elections are actually made by election officials. They're not created by legislatures, because you just need too much detail and too much discretion to do the job. So if the ISLT is embraced, then all that's going to evaporate. And then legislatures are going to have to make all the rules, which we know that they're not capable of. So electoral chaos going to be a total disaster. So that's why we're really invested in stopping it. Now, what's going on with the court? I mean, the composition of the court's changed.
Sure.
They now have a conservative supermajority. There are now five justices to the right of Justice Roberts, Chief Justice Roberts, who has, you know, never been a champion of voting rights. And in fact, his whole kind of young legal career seemed to be organized around cutting back on the VRA. So that's not a positive development. That being said, this case is still winnable. I don't make predictions, but I just want to make sure people understand what's actually going on here. So last term's opinions in Dobbs, the abortion rights case, you know, their opinion in the New York gun case, horrendous. They did not seem like they were much interested in paying attention to facts, history, or law. But even those cases sort of pale in comparison to what we have here in terms of like the configuration of facts and law that are issues. So I can't guarantee that the court's going to do one thing or another. But what I can say is that any justice who attempts to actually, at the end of the day, write an opinion in favor of the ISLT is going to struggle mightily. They've been able to get away with it so far because their various writings that have indicated that they're interested or curious about the theory have come on the shadow docket where there really hasn't been any briefing. There haven't been any arguments. It's not very transparent. It's all private voting. We don't really know who's voting what way on these cases. The game's different. This case is now up on the merits docket, which means it's going to have a public argument. That means it's going to have the full briefing. The justices will probably have hundreds, if not thousands, of pages of stuff to read. And under any dimension, then any justice of any persuasion or methodology would use to determine how to decide this case, the case has to come out on the side of rejecting the ISLT. It starts with the text, history, framers' intent, original public meaning, precedent, the policy concerns, they all point in the direction of you got to reject the ISLT.
If they did take this radical step, which we fervently hope they would not, is it conceivable that this could even have impact on how electors are selected to be part of the Electoral College? In the 2020 election, might a law like this have allowed legislatures, rogue legislatures, to do even more than they attempted to do in trying to overturn what was the decision of the voters?
Well, critically, the ISLT is not a license to coup. I think there's been a lot of coverage in the media where the focus has really been on 2024. Now, I understand that, but I think the way to understand this instead is that, again, it's sort of like cutting back on checks and balances, or in a belts and suspenders, it's like cutting off the belt and only leaving you with the suspenders. So if all the votes are cast, and at the end of the day, the legislature or the governor just says, you know, I don't care if candidate A won, I want candidate B to win. So I'm going to certify those electors and send them up. That's going to violate all sorts of federal laws, including the federal constitution, maybe also the Electoral Count Act, or if it's reformed, the reform version of the Electoral Count Act. So there will be barriers to rogue electors schemes, and the ISLT is not like an expressway to that outcome. However, the ISLT is part and parcel of attempts to change the way elections turn out. So like the most concrete example of what I'm talking about in terms of the difference. In 2020 in Pennsylvania, the Supreme Court in Pennsylvania gave people 3 extra days to submit their mail-in ballots, or for the ballots to be received once they were mailed in order for them to count. There was a calculation made by the Trump campaign, basically, that those late arriving ballots might favor Biden. So they wanted to get them excluded. And their argument was, well, the legislature set the deadline on X date. So X plus 3 days, it's not acceptable. You should throw them out. And that's not overturning the results so much as it's deciding in the first instance whose votes count.
Count.
With the hope that at the end of the day, okay, we'll knock out, you know, these 10,000 ballots, and then our candidate will win. And then they'll be the truly elected person, and the electors will then get sent up. But, you know, that's sort of like the first thing you try. And then if you fail at that, then you try something else, like convince people to ignore the results. So they're versions, or they're all tools in the kind of election sabotage toolkit, but they are different in some critical legal respects.
The case before the U.S. Supreme Court is Moore v. Harper. It comes from North Carolina. It has huge implications for the future of democracy in our country. Tom, it's going to be argued late October. Am I right about that? Or do we have a date scheduled yet?
We don't quite know. The court hasn't scheduled it for hearing yet. It will be fully briefed up kind of around Thanksgiving. So it's possible that we get the argument sometime in December. Otherwise, it will probably be early next year.
Well, we'll be paying very close attention. Folks, you can learn pretty much anything you want to know about this case by going to the website of the Brennan Center for Justice. That's brennancenter.org, B-R-E-N-N-A-N, brennancenter.org. Tom Wolf is the deputy director of the democracy program at Brennan Center. Tom, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Coming up next, another Brennan Center expert updates us on a second vitally important Supreme Court case. Don't go away.